You're listening to the Australian Hunting and Beyond podcast with Matt, where we talk about hunting, shooting, fishing, camping, and everything else that the great outdoors has to offer. Let's get into it. Hey guys, before we get into this episode, there's a couple of things I wanted to go through. Firstly, I've got a bit of a surprise for you guys at the end of the episode. So I've been asking for Rut and Raw stories and we've got our very first one. So make sure you stick around and hear that at the end. It's been a very sad week in the hunting and shooting community with the passing of a legend, Nick Harvey. I just wanted to dedicate a little bit of time to the podcast because he was somebody that made a significant positive contribution to my life with his articles and everything he did. So what a great life. 93, I think he got to. And mate, I only hope that I can live as long as that. But his legacy will live on and it will be something that I don't think anyone will surpass. So to Nick, cheers, mate, for all the memories and rest in peace. All right, without further ado, let's get into this episode. It is a really good one. I thoroughly enjoyed it. So here it is. Exciting news, because I know I've been talking about it for a while and I finally pulled the trigger, so to speak, on the new rifle. End up going the Ticker Aspire in 308 and I'm super excited to get it. Now I've made that decision after a lot of difficulty. The next step is, well, I need to get a good scope, because if you've listened to the podcast for a while, you know my old scopes have failed me a couple of times in low light, which sucks and I'm not happy with. So I thought, who better than to get on to discuss all things scopes and also about a product that I've heard good things but haven't seen a great deal out in the marketplace, which is starting to change, which I like. So tonight I'm joined by Josh from The Modern Hunter. Josh, thanks for your time, mate. How are you?
Good, thanks, Matt. Thanks for having me on.
No worries, mate. So let's get into it. Maven Scopes, you guys are the distributor.
Yep.
Can you talk to us about how that came about? I've heard really good things about the Maven scopes, but I haven't seen a great deal out in the marketplace, especially at the local gun shops. Why
is
that?
Yeah, so Maven, I guess in the optics world, is a reasonably young company. Probably, I think they're going on 10 years old now. So it's a US company based out of Lander in Wyoming. So we're the distributor here in Australia and New Zealand. Reason you won't see them in stores is we follow the Maven US business model of direct to consumer. So the whole goal, I guess, is to make as high quality product as they can, with sort of skipping a few of those pricing tier step ups to try to hit a shelf price in stores.
Which, I mean, it is a bit of a unique system, and I know a lot of companies, not in so much the shooting community space, but external, it is one that direct to the customer has a lot of positives. You're cutting out a lot of people taking their piece of the pie along the way, which is sort of nice to the consumer. So how, if someone wants to jump and check out the Maven scopes, how are they doing that at the moment?
So our goal is to get to as many expos, club meetings, which includes hunting club meetings, archery, like 3D archery club meetings and things like that. And I guess there was a little bit of a dampener to those type of things a couple of years ago, which everyone went through. But we're trying to start to roll all that out again now. I guess the biggest thing people doing at the moment is contacting us directly. But our greatest market at the moment is just word of mouth. So guys that have used Maven or seen us at expos and club meetings and that sort of thing, telling their friends about it. So we will be trying to do a lot more things in the future to sort of get eyes on the optics, obviously.
Look, I like it. I shared one of your posts the other day because I've been talking about this with a mate for a while, and a shout out to Tristan. He put me onto it actually, because we were talking about a real lightweight rifle and walking around the hills with a lightweight rifle. And I was looking at the Hauer and tossing it up, but spoke to a couple of people and whatnot and didn't end up going down that pathway. But I think I worked it out that if you went the Hauer super light,
yep,
and the Maven scope that weighs, don't quote me, but it's around the 400 gram mark, you literally had a gun to carry around under 2.5 kilos around the hills. Man, yep. How cool is that?
Depending on what caliber you're going in, that's going to be nice on your shoulder or pretty mean on your shoulder. But yeah, you can get them pretty lightweight. I think the lightest weight offering at the moment is 330 grams. And there, yeah, the step up from that, you're around 400 and something grams.
All right. So let's talk about the scopes themselves. All right. So I've got my 308. Let's just do a bit of a role play here. What would you be recommending me to throw on that? Because that's going to be the workhorse out in the state forest chasing deer. What scope are you talking me through? If, you know, if money's not an option, forget all that. What would you be recommending?
Money's not an doesn't have a play a factor. So what I've been hunting with for the last 4 years on my 300 is the RS1. So your first focal plane scope, 2.5 to 15 by 44 mil objective, I think it is. What I've been really excited about has been coming for a little while is the new RS1.2. So, you know, as a reasonably young optics brand, that was their first scope that they brought out. They've brought out six or seven scopes since that. They've just sort of made a 0.2 option of that scope. So they've now included illuminated reticle as well as an elevation turret on top, which a lot of guys sort of have been leaning a little bit more towards. Even with your state forest hunting, just want to know that, you know, they can get the elevation dialed right in if you're taking a shot from, you know, 20 yards as we have before, or up to that 500-600 yards. So RS1.2, which is a new release from Maven, which we're stocking now. So that would be my ultimate state forest hunting scope.
I like the sound of it. One of the non-negotiables for me was that illuminated reticle.
Yep.
I've been sort of sitting there going, there's been a couple of opportunities where I've had deer in the scope, but it's been that dark or it's been that hard to see. I wasn't comfortable in trying to take the shot.
Yeah.
And that was really disappointing, especially, you know, you don't get a great deal of opportunities in the state forest. So I have been let down big time by my old scopes. So that's one at the moment and that's why I sort of say if money's not an option, because I know people invest a lot in their guns, but I think the scope's just as important, if not a little bit more important, because you can't pull the trigger if you can't see through the scope. And we know when deer like to be out and about. So the more quality glass you have, the better, in my opinion.
Agreed. Yeah, it's quite common terminology that everyone uses these days. Spend more on your scope and your glass than you do on your rifle. But I think with the illumination thing, it comes into account that you know, your reticle's just going to be a black line in most scopes, and unless you've got bright enough glass through that reticle, then your reticle's not going to stand out as well. So those you know, early hours of the morning, late evenings, it's your reticle is not going to stand out as much if your view isn't as bright. So it's going to come into it as an overall package. Yes, illumination helps, but I think you're sort of playing little bits of everything into that.
Okay, so what are the other scopes that you guys have out there, and would you recommend a couple of different ones for different scenarios?
Yeah, for sure. Depending on, I guess, the question we ask a lot for customers that want us to give them a bit of a guide is, what's your expectation of what the scope's going to do compared to what you've used before? I like all our customers to get most for their money that they can and get an optic that's up to their expectations for they're going to use. I'll always tell our customers that if I don't think something's going to meet their expectations, they, you know, maybe should look at either a different model or a different brand, which I think is hopefully why we get good customer feedback on most of our gear. So we've got the C series, so the CRS1 and CRS2. So the C series is more of our mid-level optic. So we've got, they're both in an inch tube, and then you go into the R series. So the C series, Japanese, Chinese components, all assembled in Japan. Whereas the R series is all Japanese components and assembly. A little bit difference noticeably in glass quality, overall build quality, quite similar, but you're definitely going to get more features in the R series, and the premium's paid for that as well.
I mean, that's pretty much every product. The more you invest, the better quality the tech and the gear. So
an analogy I always use with in the optics world, it's you can go to the butchery and you pay $10 for a kilo of meat. You pay $20 for 2 kilos, $30 for 3 kilos, but it doesn't quite work the same in the optics world. The more you pay, you're hitting that ceiling of quality all the time. So you're paying double, but you might be getting 20% better. You pay triple, you might get 10% better each time you go up. So it's a really difficult thing to improve on such great products that every brand has at the moment.
And look, that's, I guess there's so many different scopes out in the marketplace. Absolutely. So for me, one of the things I liked is when I got in contact with you to have a chat, I was talking directly to you. So which I personally feel that's a really big benefit because you're talking to the people that are invested in the product here in Australia. Yep. Sometimes, you know, shout out to all the guys that work in gun shops, but they all have various different opinions. They're not really understanding one product probably as well because they've got such a vast array of it, not dealing with the manufacturer, et cetera, et cetera. So there's pros and cons to all of it. But for me, I really enjoyed the fact that I rang you up. You picked up and went, yep, I can tell you about it. We had some really good conversations.
Yeah.
That has to be a win for people supporting you guys and being a, you know, a small Aussie business, which is always a win.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, don't get me wrong. I love going to gun shops, looking at all the products, all the gear, purchasing things whenever I can. You know, one of our downfalls is we're not in stores and that's the business model we have, which differs to other people. So that's one of our downfalls. But I guess the pro is, you know, when you give us a call or send us an email, you're dealing directly with the supplier here in Australia and New Zealand. So, you know, we'll get any questions answered that you have, any stock that we're out of getting as soon as we can. Deal with us directly. And we're definitely of the mindset that we don't want to sell a product to someone that we don't think is going to be suitable. We want all our customers to be happy with their purchase. That's one of our biggest things. If someone rings me up and they're ready to spend $3,000 on a product they only need to spend $1,000 for, we're more than happy to guide them in the right direction for that.
I mean, that's pretty exciting. It's got to feel pretty good to have the rights and be the distributor for such a good product out there. But you've gone a step further as well, and I believe you guys are importing Tricer now.
Correct. Yeah, really exciting. Something that we've been looking at for a little while. Great brand, great products. We were pretty amazed once we actually got the products into Australia and got to check them out firsthand, everything they have. And yeah, really good quality product.
So where did this business come about? Like, how long's the Modern Hunter been going for? How did it come about? As you said, you're not in gun stores, so that sort of not, I wouldn't say a hindrance, but just makes the exposure a little less. So yeah, can you give our listeners maybe a bit of background about your company?
Yeah, absolutely. I guess it came about, you know, I was probably a little bit later than some others into the shooting game, sort of early mid-20s. So I got my hands on my first firearm and firearms license and pretty much started off doing a lot of fox shooting, sort of spotlighting and that sort of thing, and had no idea that you'd find deer in the Australian bush. And once I discovered that, I got a bit hooked, like a lot of guys did, and was just amazed, really. And that's when I started looking at, you know, bigger calibers, different rifles. I think I probably did 8 hunting trips in a row without even seeing a deer, until I really started to do a bit more study and practice and learn what was actually going on. So yeah, the business came out of a little bit of a shooting background, plenty of, you know, retail and business background as well, and just a love for anything products related in this industry. Just love firearms, optics, gear, kit, just anything I could get my hands on. And yeah, it came through a business that was previously in, and it sort of transformed into the Modern Hunter. Ran a few different products in the past with backpack companies and that sort of thing, and yeah, decided one day that really wanted to narrow it down and hit the market a lot better with, you know, a lesser broadness of products. And Maven was, yeah, we already had that on board, so that's what we narrowed down to sort of start fresh. And yeah, went from there.
I mean, that's pretty cool. There's a lot of people out there that would love to have a job in the, you know, selling things that they're passionate about. So how's the journey gone? So you said you started out chasing foxes, and similar to me, I didn't even know there was deer here until sort of found out and then went, oh, yep, got into the state forest. So that's been a pretty interesting journey. I've thoroughly enjoyed it. I wouldn't change a thing.
Yep.
What do you mainly hunt now? What are you chasing? Are you excited for the rut coming up? I know that's getting closer and closer. It keeps me awake at night. I know that much.
Absolutely. I think it gets to later in the year, at the end. So 2023, did a fair bit of, of deer shooting and got to, you know, starting to get past that midpoint of the year, and, you know, freezers were full and I'd probably had a bit of enough of packing and unpacking by then. But yeah, now it's end of January, getting towards February, and it's, yeah, everyone I think is starting to get a lot more keen again. So yeah, still do a little bit of fox shooting, spotlighting and that sort of thing. That's just a nice weekday, nighttime activity. But definitely, yeah, getting out in the state forest is, yeah, chasing fallow and red deer and hopefully some sambar this year's what I'm keen for.
And it's such an exciting time of the year at the moment because, as I said, it's I think we're recording this, it's the 30th of January, so we're just about to tick over to Feb.
Yeah.
And I know I've got a couple of trips planned for Feb because I want to start scouting and really try and hit this rut a lot harder. Last year was my first rut. And that was the first time I've heard croaking fallow. And
amazing.
Holy crap, man. I remember it like it was yesterday, and I'm just so excited to try and get that opportunity again. And hopefully this time get a bit luckier than last time. But, I mean, it depends what you say. Lucky is I having a buck and three does run past me at 7 meters, fly past me while he was chasing and croaking at him. Man, that is just, it's like it's burnt into my brain. I cannot get it out of my mind.
It's addictive. It's
it's
adrenaline. You're not thinking about anything else. As soon as you hear that, you're like, right, let's go that way. It's very addictive.
Oh, I've been counting down the days since it happened till they start croaking again, because I was like, all right, I need to make sure that I'm going to be there. And I caught the back end, like literally only like a day and a half of croaks.
Yeah.
And so this time I'm like, I want to be in there and hearing a lot more for a few more days at least.
Yeah.
And then I've also set the target to go and try and hear a red roar.
Yeah.
So that's, you know, that's the target. Just to hear it in person, because then I think I'll be addicted to that even more.
Absolutely.
If that's possible. But the fallow, I'm so excited for this upcoming, you know, rut. And we've started recording, and hopefully they'll be out probably maybe just before or just after this episode. But we're getting people send in stories, just some stories of previous ruts or wars and them taking. And, man, listening to them, I know how our listeners haven't heard it, but I have. And it's just even making it worse. I'm just like, you know, chomping at the bit to get out there. And I'm saying, come on, March, come on, April, let's go. So it's pretty exciting. Do you do much of your hunting in state forests?
Yeah, absolutely. Most of my hunting's state forest. So I'm based regional New South Wales, sort of halfway between Sydney and Melbourne. So I've got, there's, you know, a reasonable amount of state forests around this area that I get access to with, you know, holding reasonable numbers of fallow and sambar. There's a few red around as well. But, yeah, with the fox shooting, there's a few properties around locally for farmers and that sort of thing we go out to as well. But, yeah, state forest hunting's mostly what I'm doing. And then also got a one of the gentlemen that works for me, James, based down in Victoria. So he's, you know, he's the mad keen Vic High Country sambar hunter. So yeah, he's all over it down there, and I cover the New South Wales area.
Yeah, nice. Well, let's talk about the fallow. What, you know, we have a lot of new listeners, like new to shooting and hunting.
Yep.
What I've been asking people, what are some tips, or how are you approaching the rut? What do you tend to think is something that helps you aloud along the way?
Previous experience. Definitely. So the more you can get out there, the more you can sit and wait, the more you can not rely on thinking you're going to go out and shoot a deer the first time you're out or the second time you're out. Cover a lot of ground with, I guess, you know, have some expectation, but make sure you're just looking at the ground, looking at your surroundings, seeing where water sources are, everything like that. That, you know, there's 100 books you could read about it, but yeah, previous experience, just finding those places. If you're scouting, I'll scout a lot of different areas, and if I'm not finding much sign, then I'm moving straight on to the next one, especially if it's a new area. So I'll move and move until I find sign, and then once I find that area where I've got some good sign, I'll go back to that same spot a few times. You know, my first few, however many hunts with no idea, like a lot of beginners, I probably made as many mistakes as anyone. But yeah, I've found just that patience, I guess, and concentrating on the ground and what's around you.
All right, so I've been asking a lot of people that are mainly state forest hunters on how they hunt the state forest, because I'm really curious as to people's different methods, whether they're chasing, you know, they're more stalking, if they tend to find a great area and sit and wait more. So what do you tend to like to do? Are you more someone that's a bit more mobile, or do you like to sit quietly and wait? Yep. On a good good patch of ground?
Yeah, look, I like to think I have a lot of patience, but I like to move. I'm out there to get a bit of exercise, see whatever I can in the bush, and, you know, move around. If I'm seeing animals, it doesn't matter what, if they're deer or echidnas or wombats or kangaroos, then I know I'm sort of in those right areas. If I'd be lucky to be able to find a good vantage point and sit there for 2 hours, even though I know it would benefit me because it has in the past. But, you know, I like to move around. What's over that next gully, or through that next gully, over that next hill? What am I missing over there, sort of thing? So I definitely move around a lot. But it's sort of, you know, within those areas that if I'm not finding sign in an area, or if I haven't been there previously, I'm absolutely moving. You know, I'll have the patience to sit and wait if it's somewhere I've scouted before and found previous sign.
All right, so let's talk about the other optics that are out there and talk about some binos, because I want to hear about the mavens, but then I also want to talk about how you use them.
Yes, yep. Mavens, the binoculars were sort of their entry into the optics market, which was the B series. So they're, all Japanese parts and components, all assembled in the United States. So we've got the two different ranges, so C series and B series. So the C series, like the rifle scopes, is our mid-level optic. They're assembled in the Philippines, and the B series assembled in the United States. So we probably our best selling optics, and I think it's probably because they're most commonly used and have been for the last 10, 20, 30 years, whatever it is, and I think it comes down to it's because of what has been available in Australia. So, you know, 10x42 binoculars. It's been the most common for however many years. We've got a couple of different offerings around that with a bit of variation to what else is on the market, like the B2 coming in a 45mm objective. That's been really popular. I think because it's, you know, you've got a different prism system internally, which has a little bit more, I guess, gives a little bit more quality to the optic, but you're in a 45mm objective, so you're not having to bump right up to a 50 or something like that. But yeah, we've got a pretty, I guess the line's quite standard compared to other guys on the market, and just depends what you're going to use them for. Like, we get customers anything from, you know, on the farm looking for stock. We get bird watchers, you know, guys shooting 3D archery comp, just anything really.
All right, so how do you glass when you're out and about? So you like to move a lot. When we're saying move, are you, you know, a couple of steps, glass, couple of steps, glass, or do you tend to find sign and then slow down and glass? And how do you go about that?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, if I'm in a closer area without much, if I'm in a forest that's pretty dense, I'll be doing a lot of glassing if I'm trying to move around the areas. But what I'll mostly try to do is find a better vantage point. So I'll head up a little bit higher if I have the opportunity, and glass from there. And as long as I'm not opening myself to vision from a different area that I haven't glassed yet, then I'm still on the move. I'm not sprinting, but, you know, walking pace will be pretty casual until I find and, you know, go around that next bend or something like that. So, yeah, high vantage point, glassing as much as I can see from there. If I've moved up another 20 meters and another area opens up, then I'm glassing again, unless I'm, you know, heading to somewhere that I know I'm set out for and been to before. That's usually the tactic.
Yeah, no, it's interesting because I know, speaking to a couple of people, they'll take three steps and they'll glass, and I struggle with doing it so often, and, you know, that might be why I'm not so successful, but it's one of those things, trying to find that right balance. And I love asking people the different questions on how you do it and what you're finding. It's just, it's interesting to hear people have such a vast array of things that work for them.
Yeah.
And if it works, as far as I'm concerned, like, if you find something.
Yeah, absolutely. I know guys that will park the ute, walk 100 metres up the hill, and they'll sit there for 8 hours. It's not for me. I'm out there to find animals. If I bump something because I haven't glassed 10 metres ago, then I've bumped something, and I know it's there. I haven't missed it. It's another opportunity for later on. I know that's not how a lot of guys will do it, but I'd prefer to bump something and know I've been aware of it than not see it at all. But yeah, taking your time's a good thing to do. But I think with everyone these days, some guys might get 4 days a year to go hunting, and they want to make the most of it. Some guys might get a month worth. It's different for everyone, I think.
Yeah, and I think that's important, is that I don't think there's a right and wrong way, and your circumstances do things. So, like, I put my hand up, I don't spend anywhere enough time in the state forest to be a really successful hunter.
Yeah.
And that's fine. I understand that, have no issue with that. So for me, getting out there, I'm enjoying the time out there, and I'm hoping it pays off, but I'm sort of going in the back of my mind going, hey, it's probably not, because I haven't done enough time scouting. I haven't done enough time and, you know, the legwork to be super successful. So it is what it is. But I love getting out there. And it's such, as you said before, you touched on it, which I loved, was it's exercise. It's good for you. It's,
absolutely.
You know, I always say a day in the bush is a win. It doesn't matter what happens. Like, unless, you know, something goes terribly wrong and you need to get evacuated.
Flat tower at the minimum, hopefully.
Yeah. I think you're pretty good in there, you know, and whether you're seeing whatever, you know, and I've said it on the podcast and probably people are overhearing about it, but one of my best memories was sitting down just having a break and an echidna came up and went through my legs, you know, and I was like, man, far out. That's just so cool. Amazing. That's a cool experience.
Absolutely.
And I think hunting means different things to different people. And I think that's, you know, it's one of those things is I don't think hunters, like every sort of group, it's hard to put yourself in other people's shoes. So everyone sees it from their own sort of perspectives like.
Yep.
And I think that's one of the things, is that everyone has a different reason for doing it. And, you know, I try and be super tolerant for everyone, because it's sort of like, well, just because I don't agree with what they're doing doesn't mean it's wrong.
Yep.
You know, it's one of those things that they might sit there and go, well, what you're doing is wrong too. And I saw a post the other day on the fallow Deer Hunters of Australia at iAdmin, and it was, maybe it wasn't that, but either way, it was a person shot a fallow and a fawn.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a bit of the comments were super interesting, and he sort of copped a hammering, but at the end of the day, he was taking it and he was taking it to eat as well. And it was sort of like, well, you know, he's there for meat.
Yep.
I don't personally see the issue with it. I think that it's better than him leaving the fawn and, you know, it starving to death or whatever happens. It was humane. He got both. That's a win. But for a lot of people, that's not. So it was sort of interesting to see. And I guess that's just different people's perspectives. That's hunting, isn't it?
So many different demographics. Like, you'll have
yeah.
you'll have a farmer that has a property overrun with fallow and they've, you know, they've got to cull them, or you'll have poor bloke in Sydney that doesn't have as many hunting opportunities that would love to just go and shoot a fallow on a property and be able to take all the meat. There's just so many demographics and reasons. I think it's, you know, part the reason that I guess I created the business name that I did, just, you know, the old school hunter that was, you know, the bogan hunter in Australia that carried around his rifle on his shoulder and everything like that. It wasn't sort of how I saw myself or saw my mates or anything like that. And I just wanted to, you know, hopefully create, if I could, just a little bit different perspective on it, being the modern hunter. And it's, you know, it's however you want to do it and you want to portray yourself. And yeah, hopefully everyone represents themselves in the best way possibly. But yeah, that's sort of where we, I guess, came out of.
That I like it, because that sort of resonates with me. A few things you just said. A, the bloke in Sydney, because that's me, that doesn't get out that much. And when I do, it's quite a long journey. I like to head down the Snowies. That's where I predominantly hit the state forests. And it's a hike. I think the closest is probably just over 3.5 hours away. So it's not, you know, it's not something I can do just as a quick trip to throw some trail cameras out and come straight home. So it's a bit of a mission. And then with the young family, that makes it more difficult. So I get that side of it, but it's really interesting because I'm meeting a heap of different people, and I think you're right. The perception of the hunter or what it was back in the past is starting to change drastically because the lack of, I guess, private access for a lot of people. I've really struggled with private access and I get it. Like I'm not complaining about it. I understand where a farmer that's 3 hours away who has absolutely no idea who I am, why would they let me on? I get it. So there's those other opportunities that you've got to seek, which is why I love the fact that we've got state forest hunting. I think it's amazing. And, it really sucks for those people up in Queensland. I say that all the time, that they have to travel down to New South Wales.
Yeah.
And, you know, it scares me a little bit with what's going on in Victoria, seeing that they've, you know, potentially want to reclassify a lot of the forests down there.
The other day. Yeah.
Oh, man, that scares the crap out of me because I sort of sit there and go, if people are like me and they only have access to state forests mainly to hunt and that gets taken away and they don't have that private access, they probably just drop out and they'll go on to something else. And I think that's
good.
It is. Yeah, I get it. And I've said it on the podcast. I introduced a couple of mates into hunting and shooting and they went, what? You've been, you know, how long, you've gone to the state forest. How long do you drive? How long do you spend in there? You haven't got anything. And that you can see them just going, oh, shit, I don't want to do that. You know, it's already going into that too hard basket. And hey, some people might say, oh, we don't want them to be hunters. Okay, I get that. But we also need hunters' numbers to be up there because that is what holds political power. And unfortunately in the modern world is that's what's going to be whether we thrive as a sport or if it's, you know, our demise as a sport too. So it's a really tricky. So I do like the fact that you've called it the modern hunter because I think the old school is just people out in the country shooting and pest control and hunting out there with opportunities is changing. There's a lot of shooters and hunters up here in Sydney and they are, you know, coming from all walks of life. I'm amazed at the amount of doctors, lawyers, solicitors, you know, different people who are getting involved. Like I'm a teacher. I know a heap of teachers that are hunters, you know, so it's such a vast array of people now and especially a lot of, I guess, professionals or educated, you know, with that tertiary education from university. So it's a different group dynamic now and that's starting to evolve and shift and I think that's only going to benefit what we do.
Yeah, I definitely think once the meat harvesting perspective comes into it, for a lot of people, they click and they sort of get the understanding, well, you know, I've been buying meat all these years, I may as well figure out where it comes from. But I think that's a really good driver for behind you know, hunting in Australia as a whole is the meat harvesting. I know that's why we're doing it a lot and probably why I get to the end of the hunting season and the freezer's full and I don't feel like going out anymore. But
oh, I get it. It's a lot of work too. Like I got my first deer at the end of last year and it's such a long time. Like I remember, you know, obviously not super great at it. Like I've done my kangaroo harvesters TAFE course and things like that. And so I have an understanding of the butchering, haven't done too many, but I don't think it's that difficult if you just follow the seams and whatnot.
Exactly.
But then chopping it up and putting vac sealing it and then labeling and then by the time you do all that, geez, it can be a very time consuming process. So
absolutely.
It just adds to it. And I think a lot of people miss that sort of element of it, especially if you haven't done it yet and you haven't sort of been successful. And it worries me a little bit on people that haven't sort of thought about that back end because it's hard enough to get the deer. And then when you get it, like, oh, what do I do? And I've heard some stories of people shooting deer and then going, oh, shit, I absolutely know nothing of what to do here.
Yeah.
And calling people to come and help. And I get that side of it, but I also, you know, I want to be good at it. But it is such a time-consuming thing. And I think people miss that brief moment of pulling the trigger. That's what people think of. And they don't think about all the hard work beforehand, all the lead up, all the scouting, all the walking, and the back end of how you treat the animal at the end, like, you know, using as much meat as possible, breaking it down, as you said, putting it in the freezer. There's so much work to it. But look, it's so rewarding at the end of the day to get such great meat as well.
Absolutely. A lot of work involved, even once you do sort of take the animal out of the forest and get it home and, you know, hang it for a little while. I think you know, preparation is the best way to do it. Have a really nice, big, clear table. Have all your bags ready to go. And, yeah, there's a lot of work.
So two things is how do you hang it? You know, that's a contextual sort of problem for a lot of people if they don't have the space to hang it whole or break it down. How do you go about it personally?
Yep, summer or winter. Depends on the season.
Well, I suppose you're being down there, you're probably cold enough to winter just chuck it outside.
Yeah, standardly, taking the animal whole, obviously gutted and headless, and it'll hang in the shed. Got a little bit of space in there for, you know, depending on the temperature, the colder it is, the longer I'll leave it. Then, yeah, skin off, quarter out. I like to take muscle portions off while it's still hanging, just get a lot more leverage, and gravity helps with that. And, yeah, going from there in the kitchen. But, yeah, it'll sometimes be a quartering out job and back straps and legs and whatever else we can get at the time. And, yeah, the warmer weather, it doesn't stay out for as long, obviously. But, yeah, definitely a big process, but that's the general way we do it. I've tried vac sealing. I've tried just plastic wrapping, butcher's paper, done a bit of everything and not found too much variation. Just found, the longer it's been in the freezer and still being able to age in the freezer, a lot of this meat's been getting better and better, so...
Yeah, right. Okay, that's good to know. Favorite way to cook it?
Oh, I've done venison pizzas. Love a pizza. So venison pizza was really good. Burgers for sure. Bit of minced venison. Add a bit of pork in for burgers. But yeah, just a backstrap steak is awesome as well. I don't know if I have a favorite. I think just the variation of how we do it's my favorite.
I'm big on cooking. Absolutely love it.
Yeah.
So it's one of those things. The problem I've had is I've got so many ideas and different ideas of how I want to treat it and what I'm going to do with it. I probably need to get another deer because I've run out of meat already and I've done all these different things with it. And I'm like, oh, okay, I need to fix that one up. So
yeah,
it is one of those, I guess, problems. Mate, what's your favorite memory? What's the best, you know, hunting trip you've had, and was it successful or was it just a great trip?
We've done recently. We did a Vic trip recently with a few guys down to a hunt, down to a hut in Victoria. Saw a few deer, didn't put anything on the ground late afternoon by the time we saw anything on the run. But yeah, just really, really good bunch of guys. Two nights in a hut, got to see some really good country. The last year just gone had fair bit of success on the reds. So yeah, really, really early morning hunts, glassing reds from, you know, kilometer 1500 away, and then doing the stalk into sort of 250, 200 and taking two really nice stags. So there's been, yeah, last year was really, really good, and the year before, really nice fallow on a hunt. Probably, yeah, that actually the 2 years ago, I was driving, went and saw some mates up in one of the state forests, and as I was leaving, I saw a stag, fallow stag, just standing on the side of the road, fallow buck, sorry, on the edge of the road, and sort of pulled up. He didn't go anywhere. I didn't have a permit for that forest at the time, so I was just watching him, and then he's just trotted off. I thought, all right, we'll go back and have a look for him when we get a permit tomorrow or the next day. So I went back out with a mate the next day. We both got permits, went out, and we decided, oh, we'll camp for the night. And he'd not shot a state forest buck before. So, yeah, the next morning got up nice and early. We were hearing croaks all night, all morning, wandering around in circles, sit still for a while, came up with a game plan. And we thought, we'll attack that next gully, go down there and see what we can find. After, what was it, 4 hours of hiking around, wet boots, wet everything, probably 200-300 yards from the vehicles, I see a little bit of a rustle on the edge of the bush, and pointed my mate in the right direction. I said, just lift your head up a little bit more. I think you'll see our mate we saw on the side of the road the other day. So there he was, and took him. So that was a really good moment. Yeah, mate's first state forest fallow buck, and he ended up getting him mounted, and I tracked down another one, nice chocolate buck, later in that afternoon. So I think that was a couple of nights camping, and it was, yeah, so interesting to see that buck I saw 2 days prior, floating around the same sort of area. There was lots of other deer around, but not the one that we were chasing. And then, yeah, finally tracked him down.
That's pretty cool. I sort of sit there and I put some trail camera footage up on YouTube of some of the spots I've had him in, and there's a couple of different fallow bucks. So I'm super keen, you know, to try and get down there and see them. It's funny though, isn't it? Because when you're on public land, you're sort of sitting there going, I wonder, like it's in my mind that I wonder if they've been taken already.
Especially when you hear the first shot at 6:30, the second shot at 7, third, fourth, or fifth by 8 o'clock, and you know, don't know what that is, but yeah.
It's public land hunting, hey. It's all part of the whole process of it. But I sort of sit there and it's just, I sometimes lay there at night and go, I wonder if they're still there. Like, yeah. I just got there, they're there. And then the one I missed last year too, and I'm going, I wonder if he's still about and will I get the opportunity? And it's just, I think even that, just to have something that you get so excited for, I think as you get older, they diminish, yeah, and it gets less and less to get something that just excites you to the point where you're laying awake at night, just can't sleep. And I get like that every, yep, time I have a hunt.
Yeah.
Every time I know I'm going away or whatnot, I just lay there. Even sometimes I'll wake up at 4 a.m. or 3 a.m. and I've got fallow on the brain at the moment. So yeah, it's probably not great for the sleep habits, no, but it's exciting. It's something, yep, that I just sit there and go, oh, let's
it's
go.
Like, it's so, just interesting. It's just, yeah, everything about it, I find it super interesting. And then once you start looking at the other species as well, it's just, yeah, it's never ending.
Yeah, I'm with you there, because I just sit there and go, I really want to learn about all of them. They're just such amazing creatures.
Yeah.
And they've all got their own, you know, special sort of habits and different ways to do it. And I think that's been such, I guess, one of the things of the podcast that I've loved is talking to different people and hearing just different ways to attack different animals and what they've found. And it's all these things that it's sort of, I absorb it all in, and then when I get out there, just put different things into place.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm big on, I always say, I don't mind the acronym sort of fail. Like, mm-hmm, I see if you fail, it's a first attempt in learning.
Yeah.
So if you learn from that, it's not a big deal. If you do the same thing over and over and over and get it wrong, yep, well, you're not learning. So then it's a proper fail.
Yeah.
But, you know, for me, that's the whole journey about this, to keep learning as much as possible about those, you know, fantastic animals and just getting out there and chasing them. Because when you reflect on it, a lot of people will never do that.
No,
and absolutely, especially in this country, you think it is such a small minority that will get the chance to do such a thing. I think it's just such a privilege that we are able to do it and go out there. And, you know, it gets really exciting for me. I don't want to wish time away with my children, because I love the age they're at, being so little and just playful. But I really want them to get older and get out with me and, yeah, and be that age where they're understanding it and learning as well. Because I didn't have that. I was a late onset hunter, yeah, as the term is now. But very similar to yourself, I had a gun license, I think 20 or something around that age, and yeah, just hit 40, but really didn't chase deer till 2019, and then COVID hit, yep, and whatnot. So it was a bit of a pain in the ass, and the bushfires, it was just not a great great start to it. But, you know, with all that behind us, that's fantastic. And that's what I think gets me more excited, is now having a bit more time to get out there and chase them. And, you know, learning a lot with the podcast has been fantastic. And I know a few listeners are the same. They've, you know, I love when I get a message from someone that got their first deer in a state forest, or they just got their first deer in general, and they've said, oh, man, just wanted to let you know. And, you know, just listening to the podcast has helped.
Yeah, good.
You know, it's awesome, because, you know, I'm on that journey too, and it's great that other people are on that journey with us. So it's just an awesome thing. Mate, what are the future plans? So, you know, you guys are growing. It's exciting with some new products coming out of Maven.
Yeah, for sure. There, you know, there's always undisclosed future releases, which we will see in the future, I guess. But yeah, definitely on the up and up. So it's always been sort of one of those, I guess, semi full time to full time roles. But we're really wanting to, I guess we're getting more popular now and really wanting to get into the community a lot more, you know, access with, you know, attending archery club meetings, 3D archery shoots and that sort of thing. We've got the expo coming up later in the year. We're associated with a lot of hunting clubs now as well, that we get to meetings with and that sort of thing. So yeah, really trying to just travel around and get out there, chat to people, do range days and all that sort of thing. And yeah, just chat to everyone out there that's into the same sort of stuff we are, because it's what we enjoy. So we've got a revised or updated new website being launched, probably be complete by the time this podcast goes live. A few new things on there. So yeah, there's a fair bit happening that we're aiming towards. Yeah,
that's super exciting, and I think that's it's one of those things that the more you get it out there and the more people that see it, I think it'll just go from strength to strength, and it'll be fantastic to see that grow. If people are in a club or associated, they want to get a hold of you, how do they find you? What's your social so they can jump on it, track you down?
Yeah, for sure. So social media is The Modern Hunter Australia, so Instagram and Facebook. Online website, go there, themodernhunter.com.au. My email address, contact details, phone number, and everything is there. Love when people call me and want to chat about hunting and optics. And if they're interested in optics, I can point them in the right or wrong direction, hopefully. Yeah, so all those details are there.
Fantastic. Well, guys, I've had a great time. It's good to hear some things. I know with the upcoming rut, we're all probably looking at gear and thinking, what can we get better? What can we upgrade? Like I always do. It's a problem. Yep. It's very hard to talk about this stuff because my wife does listen to the podcast occasionally and I have been caught out multiple times talking about upgrading or spending money. And yes, that's never a good thing. So yeah. She's very forgiving, thank God. So I'm very lucky in that.
You just have to get the meat harvest savings, money savings across.
Man, I've been asking her to come on the podcast because as a couple of people that are mates can attest to, she gives me so much crap because we grow all our own veggies and she's got the chooks up there and everything that she's doing is just producing heaps. So we're like 80% of the veggies we eat are straight out of her garden.
Yeah.
So literally I just cop it that I just can't supply the meat anywhere near as consistently as she can, because it was that I couldn't even get a deer. And then when I got that, it turned into, well, it doesn't come often enough. You know, there's not enough of it. So it's been that rolling joke, but she's always on my back to keep me grounded, as one of my mates, Frank, always says.
Listeners, send the meat in. Listeners, send it in.
I'm all good with it because I love to earn it. I like to do the hard yards. So I've got no issue with it. But when she's saying it's the most expensive deer I've ever eaten, and it makes it a bit tricky and it makes the thing. So I've got to be careful what I say on this podcast now because she could find out or I could get dobbed in. That happens occasionally too. So got to be very, very mindful. But, mate, look, really appreciate your time coming on the podcast. I know it's one of those things. It's you're a busy man, and I appreciate you giving up your time to come on and talk to people. Guys, if you haven't, check out Maven because there is a vast array of products. They're really exciting. There's some good stuff there. The 300-odd gram one, that just to me is unbelievable. Yeah. If you're doing a lot of up and down mountains like I do, and, man, I just sit there and go, that's something that really attracts me. Shaving a bit of weight here and there is a massive win, especially walking up and down things. So check it out if you haven't already. Mate, thanks again for coming on.
No problem. Much appreciated. Thanks for having us.
Not a problem at all, mate. Love the conversation. Thanks for coming on again. And now for the listeners, as promised at the start, here we go. Our first Rut and Raw story from someone I'm sure you know, and he's got an intro.
I am here with my own theme song. Finally. The King is back on the Australian Hunting and Beyond podcast. Step aside, Frank. I've got a theme song now.
Imagine the first time you heard a croak or roar. It was pretty exciting, wasn't it? And no doubt it helped fuel the motivation to go bush and chase deer. Sounds of raiding deer up in the hills on a foggy morning are addicting, because when you hear it, it confirms that you're in the right place to start an endurance version of Marco Polo. I myself can confirm that I'm addicted to the roars of red stags and croaks of fallow bucks, but I really get more of a thrill when I see the reaction of someone who hears the sounds for the first time. Hence why I enjoy guiding when I get the opportunity to. I remember the first time I started guiding mates on red stags. Most of them have experience chasing fallow, but reds were foreign to them. On one hunt, my mate Adam was after his first red stag. During that hunt, we found ourselves caught out in an open paddock where a stag was holding upwards of 20 hinds. The hinds had spotted us and made a move to run off to safety, but the stag hadn't yet seen us. Determined to keep his harem, he bolted out and turned the hinds around like a top-notch kelpie and began mustering the large mob back towards us, which became a deadly mistake for him as he got him into rifle range of Adam to take him out. But another good first-time raw hunt was with good mate Nick. Nick has got plenty of experience bow hunting fallow, but a red stag was a dream animal for him. Due to the openness of the terrain, I advised Nick to use my rifle when we set out looking out for deer. When we arrived to the property, I noticed a ute bogged out in the paddock where I had planted the glass for the morning. Deciding that the owner of the ute probably spooked everything off the property when they walked back to the house, I took Nick to a backup property. From there, we began glassing on the surrounding hills looking for any deer. At first, we could only find a knobby stag with a couple of hinds, but then over on the opposite hill face, we heard. We looked over and got eyes onto a good stag, and we quickly made a move down the hill we were on and moved across, climbing up a steep bank to where we last saw him. Popping over to look, we watched a pair of red hinds sprint down towards us, darted off last second with them both followed by a younger stag and the stag we were chasing hot on his heels. They ran past us down over the ridge, and just as we'd gone to give chase after them ourselves, the stag began walking back up the hill. I pulled out my camera to try and start filming just as Nick raised the rifle up beside me. And as I got the stag into frame, the stag took the hit and ran downhill out of sight. I had pre-warned Nick before that if the deer didn't go down after the first shot, he'd have to reload and take a second. Worried it wasn't a fatal hit, we gave chase to where we last saw him. And I was quite happy when we reached the top of the hill to report to Nick it was a good shot, as I could see the stag down on the ground. I could see instant relief on Nick as we approached the 10-point red stag. And after a few moments of admiration of the animal and recalling what happened, we loaded him up on the back of the ute, butchered him and caped him out. Although the meat is well and truly gone by now, the stag hangs proudly in Nick's home. Unfortunately, not every hunt is successful. You will make mistakes along the way in pursuing deer. An example of this was when out hunting with a mate chasing a particular deer. I had seen the stag while out scouting and watched him lock antlers with another stag in a fight for dominance. I returned a couple of days later on a wet and horribly windy day to try and relocate him. And I did. The stag stood in some thick scrub with a few hinds offering a perfect broadside shot, which I took. The stag instantly hit the ground, and I was pretty certain I had a good new PB on the ground. But I was greatly mistaken. Somehow the stag had got back onto his feet and took off running. We tracked his prints but could never find blood, and he was gone. What happened? What went wrong, you may wonder? Well, to put it simply, I shot too high. There's a section between the spine and the shoulder where there's a pocket of just nothing. The stag took the bullet, no doubt, and certainly felt the hit, but it didn't hit anywhere vital or do any long-term damage. I later found out in the following rut season that a hunter on a neighbouring property had hunted the stag and had showed he was pretty healthy with no visible damage to him and was still riding hard. You can never really predict how a hunt will unfold, but all you can do when out bush is keep hunting and hunt hard.
If you have a topic, guest, question, or any gear that you want to hear about on the podcast, shoot us an email, australianhuntingandbeyond@gmail.com. Alternatively, find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. All the links are in the show notes. If you haven't already, make sure you give us a review and subscribe to our podcast on whatever platform you're listening on. Thanks for joining us, and we'll catch you next time.